Hello, it's Wednesday the 26th of August. My name's John Dennis. Today, how Barack Obama plans to restart peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians.
One of the factors that's come into play in leveraging this deal has been the Iran question.
Also today, Gordon Brown still under pressure after breaking his silence on the Lockerbie bombers release.
We had no role in making the decision about Mughrabi's future.
And how Soviet generals planned to invade Manchester.
We can but speculate at this distance. It was obviously important enough for the Russian military to invest a large amount of money in doing this mapping.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton's got the news and a look at the papers.
Barack Obama is close to brokering an Israeli-Palestinian deal, allowing him to announce a resumption of the long-stalled Middle East peace talks. According to US, Israeli, Palestinian and European officials, the key to bringing Israel on board is a promise by the US to adopt a much tougher line over Iran's nuclear ambitions. In return, the Israeli government will be expected to agree to a partial freeze on the construction of settlements in the Middle East. Although the negotiations are being held in private, they're at such an advanced stage, both France and Russia have approached the US, offering to host a peace conference. We'll be discussing this in more detail with our diplomatic editor in just a moment. Senator Edward Kennedy has died. He was 77 and had been battling a brain tumour. For nearly a half century in the Senate, he was a dominant voice on healthcare and civil rights, but perhaps best known for being the most senior living member of the Kennedy dynasty. A man's been stabbed in the chest following large-scale football violence in London. At least 10 people have been arrested after bitter rivalry between West Ham and Millwall supporters erupted before the game at Upton Park. Onlookers say bricks and bottles were thrown as hundreds rioted. Inside the ground, fans fought with police and stewards, and play was suspended when dozens of fans invaded the pitch. Police and club officials are now scouring CCTV footage to pinpoint those responsible for what's been described as planned scuffles. The Football Association says anyone involved will be banned from football for life. Environmental protesters will be photographed by police as they arrive at a climate camp somewhere in London today. Senior officers have confirmed the deeply unpopular tactic of recording those taking part in demonstrations will continue. Police had asked protesters to tell them where the camp will take place and what participants will get up to. About 200 extra officers have been drafted in from five forces. The operations in the spotlight after angry clashes marred demonstrations during the April G20 meetings in London. Manchester City have taken their summer spending to a staggering £120 million. Julian Lescott's five-year move from Everton's costing them an initial £22 million. The 27-year-old could make his debut for Mark Hughes' team against Portsmouth on Sunday. The papers now, and starting with The Telegraph, which claims power firms are overcharging customers by almost £100 a year. The government's consumer watchdog says they're not passing on their price cuts. Climate change campaigners will target the Dirty Dozen, according to The Independent, as part of a week-long series of demonstrations. Company offices and government departments will be hit. Crunch time for council workers. Golden pensions is the headline in The Times, as it says millions of public sector workers will have their payouts cut to deal with a massive shortfall in the value of pension funds. The Express reports on plans for a national congestion charge, which could cost £1.34 per mile. And ending on The Mirror, which looks at a rather expensive cut and blow dry, the headline says it best, a snip at £20,000. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meets Barack Obama's Middle East peace envoy George Mitchell today in London. The issue of Israeli settlements is central to their discussions. Palestinians have said there can be no negotiations with the Israelis until they stop building settlements on occupied land. But diplomats expect progress on that issue, enough to allow Barack Obama to unveil a new Middle East peace process in the autumn. Julian Borgia is our diplomatic editor.
Well, the idea is to get some basic breakthroughs with the Israelis and Palestinians to the extent that they will be able to talk about by the end of next month, probably at the UN General Assembly in New York, to talk about a new peace plan so that President Obama will be able to go before the General Assembly and lay out a new US brokered peace plan.
Are all the pieces of the jigsaw on the table in order for this to be put together?
Well, they're on the table right now in London as Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, meets George Mitchell this morning in London. And at the centre of this is the issue of settlements. It's long been a sticking point in Israeli-Palestinian talks. The attempt to get those talks restarted has been the expansion, continued growth of Israeli settlements. Now, both Israelis and the Americans believe they're close to a deal in terms of a freeze, or at least a partial freeze, on those settlements. And one of the factors that's come into play in leveraging this deal has been the Iran question. What the Americans are seeking to do are, by pledging serious, tough action against Iran over its nuclear program, targeting Iran's most vulnerable sector, oil and gas, the Obama administration is seeking to use that as a quid pro quo with the Israelis, saying, we'll do this, we want you to get tough on settlements.
Has Netanyahu calculated that Iran now poses the greatest existential threat to Israel?
Yes, that's very much Netanyahu's view, and the view of most of the Israeli political class. And that, in a way, is what gives Obama leverage, because he can say, this is your biggest problem, Iran. In comparison, settlements and your desire to hang on to Jewish settlements in the West Bank is minimal in importance.
And what about the role of other countries other than the United States in developing this peace process?
Well, the role of the Arab states, the Gulf states, is going to be critical on both fronts. And both these Arab states are preoccupied with both problems. And there again, the Obama administration is hoping to find some kind of synergy. The Arab states want a deal, desperately want a deal that will give Palestinians a viable state. At the same time, they're looking for U.S. protection if Iran shows signs of going nuclear. So there again, the two big issues in the Middle East, Iran and Israel-Palestine, are coming together, and the hope is to use one to help solve the other.
What are the dangers involved in going down this road?
Well, the big danger, of course, if you bring two big problems together, try to link them, you can end up complicating both. You make one the hostage of the other. And so if something goes wrong in terms of the effort to contain or curb Iran's nuclear program, that can have a blowback effect on Israel-Palestinian talks. The effort to isolate Iran further is fraught with difficulty. It could alienate Russia and China and break what has been up to now more or less an international consensus on dealing with Iran. And it's by no means easy to enforce an embargo. To go out into the Straits of Hormuz and enforce it with gunboats would be an act of war. To try and do it by punishing firms, companies, oil companies that sell refined petroleum to Iran is easily dodged by the sort of sanctions busting that we saw in the attempt to isolate Iraq.
Julian Borger. Well, yesterday, Netanyahu met Gordon Brown at Downing Street, with the British Prime Minister reiterating the importance of halting settlements. Netanyahu stressed the threat from Iran and the need for Palestinians to recognise Israel, as well as talking about settlements.
I think we're trying to achieve two goals. One is to reactivate the peace process, and the second is to enable normal life for the Israeli residents in Judea Samaria. We have about 250,000 such people. They lead lives. They have children. They have to go to school. They need classrooms. They need kindergartens. They need to have a place to house the families. This is very different from grabbing land. And I've made it clear that we're not going to build new settlements or expropriate additional land for existing ones.
The Guardian's been publishing a series of articles this week focusing on Israeli settlements. Our Middle East correspondent, Rory McCarthy, is in Jerusalem. I asked him about the cost to Israel of the settlements.
It's difficult to calculate the cost exactly. Essentially, it's hidden in lots of different budgets of the Israeli government. But people have been trying to estimate this over the years, and we can certainly say it's cost several billion pounds. This sort of cost is borne out in terms of construction, providing infrastructure for the settlements, providing security for them, offering incentives to encourage Israelis to live there, incentives like subsidized mortgages, and that sort of thing. This settlement project's been going on now for about 40 years. And there are about 500,000 Jewish settlers living in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. So we're talking about a really large number of people.
Could Netanyahu deliver on any promise to stop building settlements?
That's difficult. He's clearly under pressure, and I suspect that some kind of compromise is likely to be worked out. But Netanyahu is the prime minister of a right-wing coalition, and there are many people in his coalition who are firmly committed to the whole settlement enterprise. They believe that Jewish Israelis have a right to live in the occupied West Bank. So if he was to announce an immediate halt to all settlement activity or to start to take down any of the settlements, he'd certainly face domestic political difficulties. I suspect, therefore, what we're heading for is some kind of temporary agreement to halt settlement activity, although there will be other provisos. I think that the Israeli government wants to be able to continue building those homes and houses where construction has already begun, and they number at least 2,500. So I think we're unlikely to see any major halt to settlement construction.
And what about the other main sticking points? East Jerusalem, part of which is also claimed by the Palestinians as a capital, and Palestinian refugees.
Yeah, those are the other two issues of any peace deal. I think Netanyahu is going to make it very clear in his meetings this week that he regards East Jerusalem as a sovereign part of Israel. This is territory that was captured in 1967 and occupied and later annexed by Israel. And as far as Netanyahu and the Israeli government is concerned, this is part of Israel. And therefore, he is very unlikely, I think, to offer any, you know, pullback on settlements there, any attempt to take them down, any attempt to stop settlement building. Of course, the rest of the world regards East Jerusalem still as occupied territory, the same status as the West Bank. But I think that's going to be a red line for Netanyahu. And then in terms of refugees, that's not something that's being discussed in any great detail at the moment, but we know that Netanyahu and other senior Israeli politicians, he's not alone in this, do not want to see a return of large numbers of Palestinian refugees back into what is now Israel. As far as they're concerned, that would fundamentally alter the character of Israel. They want Israel to remain a Jewish, as they say, a Jewish and democratic state. And they do not want to allow a mass return of Palestinian refugees. They would rather it would be dealt with some sort of financial compensation and the refugees returning to live in a future Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank.
Rory McCarthy, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Israel. Also on The Guardian's website today, the Russian Obama, Joachim Kremer. He's from Guinea-Bissau, but he says he's been inspired by the US president to run for office in southern Russia. We look at the other next Barack Obamas at guardian.co.uk/America. The story of how Kathy Rogers and her family moved to Italy, bought an olive grove, and intended to live off the proceeds from the oil they produced. But it all went very wrong. Find out how at guardian.co.uk/G2. And Kira Cochrane on the food that people eat when they're alone. guardian.co.uk/food. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, a softly, softly approach by the police as climate change protesters converge on a secret location in London.
It could be anywhere in the capital. And at that point, they will do what they call a swoop, which is essentially kind of converge en masse as quickly as they can and put up their tents before police get there.
But first, Gordon Brown has said he was repulsed by the reception given to the Lockerbie bomber on his return to Libya. It was the first time the Prime Minister has spoken in public about the decision last Thursday by the Scottish Justice Secretary to release the terminally ill Abdel Basset Ali al-Megrahi on compassionate grounds. At that press conference with the Israeli PM, Brown said his government played no part in the decision.
My first thoughts have been with the families of the victims of the Lockerbie bombing. And I have to tell you that I was both angry and I was repulsed by the reception that a convicted bomber guilty of a huge terrorist crime received on his return to Libya. When I met Colonel Gaddafi over the summer, I made it absolutely clear to him that we had no role in making the decision about Megrahi's future. Because it was a quasi-judicial matter, because it was a matter legislated for by the Scottish Parliament and not by us, it was a matter over which we could not interfere and had no control over the final outcome.
So, how much political damage has Lockerbie done to Gordon Brown? In our Westminster office, our chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt.
He has faced criticism in the last few weeks for that position, and indeed last night was facing some pretty strong criticism. Ed Davey, who's the Liberal Democrats' foreign affairs spokesman, said that the Prime Minister's comments were a masterclass in evasion. And it is interesting, this. It is difficult. On the one hand, you can understand that Gordon Brown says, I cannot, as UK Prime Minister, talk about a matter that is devolved, because if I did, guess what would happen? The SNP would be on my back and say, get away. He wouldn't want a row on that front. But equally, this decision does have a huge impact on the UK's foreign policy. It has a big impact with our relations with the United States, and potentially a big impact on our relations with Libya, where the United Kingdom has some pretty serious business interests. And I think the problem that Gordon Brown has had is he has not been able to finesse that very difficult position, on the one hand, of not right for me to upset the constitutional settlement with Scotland, but on the other hand, this is a big decision for the United Kingdom. And there is a feeling, really, at Westminster, that if Tony Blair was Prime Minister, he would have found a way of finessing that. And looking to the future, David Cameron, because the Conservatives don't have that poisonous, troubled relationship that the Labour Party has with the SNP, David Cameron too would probably find a way of finessing that.
Nick, there's another story that you've been working on that I'd like to ask you about, if I may. Justice Minister Jack Straw is announcing plans to reform Britain's constitution. What's he proposing?
Well, Jack Straw is appearing this morning at an event which is taking place in the building that houses The Guardian, and talking about the next stage of House of Lords reform. He's been quite open about this, that this has been moving at a glacial pace. Some people say that this government that's been with us for 12 years hasn't really done enough, apart from expel most of the hereditary peers. And Jack Straw, I think, is going to hold up his arms and say, well, it's a bit worse than that. The Labour Party and indeed the Liberal Party have been in favour of reform for 100 years, and it's been going a bit slowly. But he will be saying that there is a consensus amongst the three main parties, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats. They are all in favour of a substantially or predominantly elected upper house. There is an agreement that it should be 80 or 100% elected. And Jack Straw is going to be setting out his thoughts about how you might embark on that journey. We'll be getting draft legislation, a bill in the Queen's speech in the autumn, legislation that's obviously introduced in a Queen's speech just before the general election, often doesn't make it onto the statute book, but nevertheless, he's going to give an indication of the direction of travel. And I think what he's going to say is that there are people who passionately believe it must be wholly elected, 100%. People who passionately believe you still need an element of having appointed members of the upper house, perhaps 20%. And he's going to say, look, I think we can find a way of moving forward, which is that we'll all agree we need to embark on the journey. Let's embark on the journey. But we don't need to say that the journey definitely ends at 100% elected or 80% elected. Let's start the journey and see how we get on, which essentially means that those who really, really passionately believe in a wholly elected upper house, well, they're going to have a bit of a wait, 10 to 15 years.
Nicholas Watt. In the first major test of police public order tactics since the G20 demonstrations, up to 1,000 anti-capitalist environmental activists begin a week of protests today. The climate camp's previous targets have been the Drax coal-fired power station in West Yorkshire, Heathrow Airport and Kingsnorth Power Station in Kent. This year, who knows? Demonstrators meet at noon today at 7 different locations in London. Paul Lewis is following the story.
Well, at noon, there will be protesters gathering at locations across the capital. And then simultaneously, if all works to plan, they'll receive text messages telling them, you know, the precise location of where the demonstration is going to be. And it could be anywhere in the capital. And at that point, they will do what they call a swoop, which is essentially kind of converge en masse as quickly as they can and put up their tents before police get there. So it'll be a bit of a cat and mouse with police, because police don't really know where the location is going to be. They will have done their best to try and find out. Whether they have, we don't know.
It's a very big challenge for the police, isn't it, after G20?
It's a huge challenge for them. I mean, they have come under unprecedented criticism, really, for their handling of that protest. And many people say, kind of unsurprisingly so, because, well, someone died and there were a huge number of complaints afterwards, two parlamentary inquiries and a review of national public order policing by the official inspectorate. That's quite a lot, really. So I think the top brass at the Met are very well aware that this is their first test since the G20 protests. And all of the signals they've been putting out is that they're going to approach this differently.
I mean, even down to inviting some climate camp activists to see the police training for this.
It's unheard of, really. I mean, they have had journalists in the past attend this. It's a kind of riot training centre in Gravesend. These are people that many police departments view as, quote unquote, domestic extremists. You know, they're the kind of, they've always been viewed as the enemy within, as some kind of, you know, subversives or dangerous in some way. And here they are inviting them, you know, into the very heart of public order policing. So that suggests a change of tact, at least. But, you know, the real test will be on the ground and the treatment of protesters. And will there be mass stop and search like there was last year, which really frustrates people? Will there be kettling, which is the notorious tactic of containing protesters in a contained area for several hours on end? We don't know, and we'll see, and I think that's when the test will be.
There have been some demonstrations, of course, on a smaller scale since G20. There were the Tamils who protested in Westminster, and some protesters who chained themselves to Peter Mandelson's house recently when he was standing in for Gordon Brown. And they were policed quite differently, weren't they?
They were. I mean, like I said, everything so far signals that there has been a bit of a change. The Tamil protest, which happened in the immediate aftermath of the G20, I mean, it was quite remarkable, really, because it was actually in Parliament Square, which is illegal to demonstrate there without prior notification. So in theory, it was an illegal demonstration. But they really treated the Tamils with kids' gloves, really. They left them a lot of space. They tried to communicate as best as possible. They weren't wearing their riot gear when they went in to tackle the demonstrators. So it was a very, very different protest. And the environmental protesters who chained themselves to Peter Mandelson's house is a good example, because there they turned up and they expected police to come and, you know, unchain them. They have special substance to kind of unglue their hands. And we're actually quite disappointed when police turned up and didn't arrest them.
They had to unglue themselves.
They had to unglue themselves. And I think, you know, they probably felt it was a bit of a missed photo opportunity.
Paul Lewis. 1974 was not a good year for the city of Manchester. There were power cuts because of the three-day week declared by Edward Heath's Tory government, and Manchester United were relegated to the second division for the first time in four decades. But it could have been a lot worse, because meanwhile in Moscow, Soviet generals were plotting an armoured invasion of Manchester, as a map now on display in the city reveals. It's been studied by Dr. Chris Perkins, a senior lecturer in geography at Manchester University.
It's a military map of Manchester, and it shows a very different geography of the city to what you would see on the Ordnance Survey maps produced in UK at the time. It's basically, it shows you what the Russian invaders would have wanted to see on a map.
So what would those things be?
The roads that they could get the tanks down, the targets that they would need to secure, the key place names in Cyrillic in the Russian alphabet. Very different, again, from what you would see on the Ordnance Survey.
What would their targets have been?
Well, they colour-code them, actually. So industry is important, obviously, if you're invading somewhere. So Trafford Park in the to the south of the Ship Canal, it's coded in black. Key industries numbered. Public buildings like the university in purple. And military sites of strategic importance like the Risley nuclear site or barracks in green.
How did this map come to light?
Well, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the map factories dotted across Russia, basically their materials became available on the Western market. And I think we got our copy via the Ministry of Defence, in fact. But, I mean, you can buy them. You can buy them over the web from American wholesalers now.
Now, the people of Manchester in the 1970s might have been quite surprised to see Russian tanks rolling into town. I mean, how close were the Russians to implementing such a plan?
We don't know. I mean, I guess NATO would have had similar mapping of other global cities. We can but speculate at this distance. It was obviously important enough for the Russian military to invest a large amount of money in doing this mapping.
How did the Russians get the information to compile this map?
Well, they use Ordnance Survey sources, but not only Ordnance Survey. So they would have used road atlases, they would have used spy satellite imagery to show the things that don't appear on the official maps, and they'd also, there's some evidence that they would have had people on the ground to actually fill in the details, to work out which factories were where.
And is there anything they've missed out?
The road network isn't as complete as it would be on Ordnance Survey because they were using slightly superseded evidence. Equally, they show things that the Ordnance Survey doesn't show. So some of the military sites that are not on our maps are actually appearing on the Russian map.
Chris Perkins, and the map is on display at the John Rylands Library for this week's Royal Geographical Society conference in Manchester. Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth were the producers of today's programme. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.